Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 31st. So the big news item today is that the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates by 25 basis points. The market had been pricing in 50 basis points and as many as 3 interest rate cuts before the end of the year. So there was some disappointment. But that was not the reason why we had volatility. In fact, there were two additional surprises. The first was that they have now ended the quantitative tightening program, and that has accelerated the schedule from the end of September to the end of July. There will be no further running off of the balance sheet beyond tomorrow, and that alone is a source of additional liquidity. But it was Jay Powell's statements in the press conference after the rate decision which caused some volatility in the markets, because he was quite clear, he was in saying that he was of the opinion that it was one and done, and that they weren't that it shouldn't be assumed that the Federal Reserve was going to continue to cut interest rates from here. But of course, that is something that he probably needed to say, because if he were to come out and say something opposite and say that they anticipate additional rate cuts before the end of the year, then that would have damaged confidence. So we had a bit of a knee-jerk reaction in terms of the initial market response. But as we approach the close, then some of that initial drawdown is being unwound. What I find particularly interesting is that the 10-year Treasury price has been completely inert for much of the last 2 months. It has generally ranged for about 2 months before breaking on the upside. And there is the possibility here that we are going to see additional rate cuts. Now, what also I think is interesting is if we look at the actual curve of the US Treasury, or the US sovereign curve. Well, rather than looking at swaps, I don't exactly know why it has defaulted to that. But what we're presented with here is the fact that the 1 month is currently yielding 1.99%. And the 1 year is yielding almost exactly the same. The 10-year is yielding 2.01%. So when we start to think about the 10-year and 2-year spread, well, the 2-year is in towards the belly of the curve. What this is pricing in is, rather than looking specifically at the spread between, for example, the 3-year, the 6-year, or for example, whatever this is, the 3 month, the 6 month, and potentially the 1 year, and those being higher than the 10 year, what this is in fact pricing in is that yields are expected to be in the order of about 1.8%, or at least another interest rate cut from here within the next 18 months, and potentially less than that. So that's one interpretation. The other is that liquidity conditions are tightening. But the yield curve spread, the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year, which has been something that I've been highlighting for much of the last decade, has not yet inverted, but it did contract rather abruptly in here today. And it's down to about 14 basis points. So it has gone from the upper side of the range to the lower side of the range in the last 2 weeks in a rather dynamic manner. And this has been very choppy action. Well, we're really not all that far away from an inverted yield curve. So there is certainly the big question, I think, that should be on the forefront of people's minds is, what is it that could really tell us when we can truly expect a recession, and where is that recession likely to be manifested? Because US growth is still positive. The US consumer is not especially levered. There are obviously pockets of high leverage. The fact that I've seen the the price of property around where I'm living in West Los Angeles has been trending higher in an aggressive manner for most of the last few years. The fact that people are borrowing rather excessive amounts and loans for trucks, for example, in the order of $70,000 and $80,000 for a pickup truck, and running that on a 12-year loan. These are the kinds of leverage that do appear rather silly, but we have not had the same kind of leverage in the domestic U.S. consumer on this occasion that we had in the last. So where is the leverage concentrated? That is the really big question. Well, it's in the corporate sector, it's in the municipal sector, and it's in the government sector. There has been an enormous amount of money borrowed by the private equity sector. Rather than think about the collateralized mortgage obligations that really were the problem back in 2006, I think it is much more likely that we're going to have a problem in the leverage loan markets. The kind of drawdown that occurred in some of these ETFs in the last few weeks of 2018 is, I think, a foretaste of the kind of liquidation that can occur in these kinds of assets when everybody heads for the door at the same time. Then, when we think about the fact, I think what I find particularly interesting is that despite the fact that Netflix has been pulling back and is representative of some of one of the most highly levered companies, its debt has been really rather well contained. And when, for example, you can look at a double B minus credit, and it is yielding 2.5%, well, that's rather extraordinary. That, I think, is a complete mispricing. There is, I think, when we think about where are the potential opportunities, well, I think there is an opportunity today in the leverage loan and high yield markets, rather similar to the kind of opportunity represented by the collateralized mortgage obligations in 2005 and 2006 from a short perspective. I think that's where the issues reside. But that's also part of the reason why the Federal Reserve has been willing to cut interest rates, why they have accelerated the end of quantitative tightening. They're, I think, exhibiting a clear knowledge of the threats and challenges that are outstanding to both the domestic US economy, but also to the global economy, because capital is both mobile and global, and it will go to the most attractive assets. The fact that we've had record low interest rates has been a massive bonus for anyone who's willing to take on leveraged positions. There was massive availability of credit, that credit was extremely cheap, and there were lots of different assets to pour it into. Well, that has been most particularly the case for private equity. The blow-up of funds like Neil Woodford or GAM or H2O, well, they all have had the similar experience of investing in these kinds of assets that are impossible to value, and then having the illiquidity of those positions coming back and biting them when they get redemptions. And that is, I think, a real potential problem that we're only beginning to see the kind of liquidity problems that that can have. There is no way of knowing right now how many other funds, regardless of size, have been engaged in this investment in private assets. And when the clear trend in the fund management sector over the last decade has been to deliver 24-hour liquidity, then how can they justify having invested in some of these private assets? There is this is a really quite considerable problem. And I think when we think about how does one, on the one hand, monitor, but on the other hand, ensure oneself against these potential fund blow-ups, well, everyone has been concentrating on the ETF sector for the last few years because of its size, because of the growth in the passive market. Well, of course, the other point, well, let's get to that in a moment. But the other point is that it's a significant number of mutual funds have been under a great deal of pressure to try and perform. Therefore, they may have started to invest in some of these illiquid assets, and they potentially represent more of a risk than some of the ETFs. Then, if you think about ETFs, well, what they in fact, everyone talks about ETFs in terms of the rise of passive investing. But in fact, what an ETF represents is a bet on the winners continuing to be winners, and therefore it is a leveraged bet on a market, a cap-weighted index, which will always favor the larger cap shares. Then it is also an earnings agnostic strategy. And that's rather important because it is obviously accepting the rationale that earnings don't matter. And well, we know that earnings do matter. The very fact that we have had this slew of companies entering the market that simply do not make any money or have got very little prospect of making a profit anytime in the near future, that they have been able to stay private for much longer than would have been normal. Well, that's a byproduct of the massive availability of liquidity. It also represents a challenge for the market. It's also something that people need to bear in mind when we look at this bubble that is continuing to inflate. Now, when we look at what's been going on in the stock market today, then the S&P 500 did pull back and it was down about 1%. There has been a loss of momentum around the 3,000 level, and that does represent a new all-time high. So far, it continues to look like a consolidation, and it will continue to look like a consolidation as long as it is sustaining the move above the trend mean. We've had three 18-month consolidations in the course of this 10-year advance, and each of those has been completed by a clear breakout on the upside. On occasion, we have had the price coming back down to test the upper side, or the, I think perhaps more correctly, the region of the previous peaks. That was certainly the case in 2016, and it was also the case in 2012. So that's why we have to give it a little bit of an extra room. But monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. There are an increasing number of things that we could worry about, but the reality is that stock markets are continuing to push on the upside. Considering the fact that approximately 50% of all debt is about one notch above junk, and we have to then consider that when things do start to go pear-shaped, it is definitely going to have an impact on the high-yield market. So it is, I think, more important than any other metric is to keep an eye on high-yield spreads. And this has had a meaningful move in 2018, and now it has pulled back to test the upper side of the almost 2-year base formation. So this does look like a first step above the base. And as long as it is holding above the 350 basis point level, then we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to medium-term upside. It's not really, though, until we start to see yields pushing above the 500 basis point level that the real effects of credit tightening start to become apparent in the wider market. It is worth also considering, well, what did it look like all the way back in 2007? Well, again, in this case, it was an almost 4-year base formation, a pretty similar in at a let me phrase that again, at a similar spread to what we've seen just recently. We then had the breakout and some consolidation, but it was really when the spread started pushing back above the 500 basis point level that we had a real credit concern starting to affect the market. That was equally true in 2011 and in 2015. So now the next question is, what is going to eventually cause some of these companies to downgrade? Then, of course, there is the other side of the equation. With companies that are potentially on the cusp of being downgraded, what do they do? Well, if we look at, for example, what GE did, well, they've started to sell off parts of the business. They have gone through massive restructuring in order to avoid being downgraded. That suggests that there is significant potential for these kinds of issues to be explored, particularly among the weaker balance sheet companies and those that have been more levered in this cycle. But not until we start to see these spreads pushing higher, and so far they're not pushing higher. When we think about other risks, well, there is obviously risks in some of the highly valued property markets internationally, such as London, Vancouver, Sydney, Hong Kong, and mainland China. China has got a laundry list of concerns on the economic front. If one had to really consider where it is likely that the next problem is going to arise, then it is quite potentially in the Chinese economy. They announced today that they are not going to provide additional stimulus for the housing market, and if they are unwilling to support the bubble in the Chinese housing market, then that really does represent a challenge. The continued downtrend in the continuous commodity index, I think, rather than telling us very much about the global economy, it probably says a lot more about Chinese demand. China is by far the swing consumer of industrial resources, and the fact that this index has been trending down for a year does suggest that we do need to be paying attention to what is going on in China. Then, when we think about Hong Kong, well, it was down in here today and now is testing the region of the trend mean. When we look at this trend overall, it's not exactly consistent, and now we have a lower high. There is also a higher low, so it is rather imperative that the lows put in right at the beginning of June do in fact hold. And I think that's a rather important point. Now, when we look at the wider market, then there is the clear scope here that it is potentially in China where problems could really arise. The fact that we have a trade war going on with no real end in sight is also something that needs to be paid attention to. I'm just going to pause for a second. When we then think about the A-share index, it is almost completely manipulated by the Chinese administration. Therefore, when we think about the regional banking sector, we have to perhaps look a little bit further. Mingsheng, for example, is trending down. It's right in the region of the lows over the course of the last year. I think that's a rather significant factor. When we look at the broader picture here, then there is the scope that it is China is where the real risk is. Then the big question is, are they going to continue to run massive deficits to support their economy? The central banks of the world are going to have to cut rates and increase liquidity. And then, of course, the relative strength of the dollar represents a challenge. The dollar broke on the upside in here today, and that has clearly reasserted the uptrend. It was touch and go 4 weeks ago, and the fact that the dollar continues to represent relative strength is sapping the supply of liquidity out there in the global economy. That is obviously something that needs to be paid attention to. I think the closest parallels that we have for the USA's continued relative strength is the fact that the dollar is strong and Wall Street is relatively well insulated, and that the problems are more international in nature. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.